Here this morning, if you'll take your Bibles, you can turn to Ephesians 5, where we'll be this morning. Ephesians 5. I understand I probably need to provide a little closure on the story from last night when my boys showed up in camo, ready to fight our neighbors, and there was no fight, and it actually turned out to be redemptive. The dad, he works the... He worked a late shift at the Ford plant that's there in Louisville, and he had no idea, like I suspected, that his boys had even gotten out and played with our stuff and taken a few of our things. And so when he found out, he marched his boys downstairs, and they returned all of our belongings, and we actually became friends through the incident. So Every neighborly challenge does not have to end up with the police being called and a lifelong rift between neighbors. We worked it out, and all is well. So sorry to disappoint if you thought there was a brawl in our neighborhood. We have had a few fights in our neighborhood over lesser things, but that's another story. Ephesians 5. This is Paul writing to the Ephesians, and we come to chapter 5 and the last part, and he addresses wives and husbands. And this is not Paul just trying to add a few marriage tips to his letter. He's building an argument of how we should walk, and now he's going to talk about how we should walk as husbands and wives. And he says, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is profound, and I'm saying that it refers to Christ and the church. However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband." So what Paul is saying here is there's a particular arrangement in the home. Husbands are to lead their wives. Wives are to submit to the leadership of their husbands. Husbands are to love their wives like Christ loved the church. Wives are to submit to their husbands as to the Lord. So they're not allowed to, they don't have to submit to their husbands if he says, "I need you to go rob this convenience store," or "I need you to lie for me here." It's as unto the Lord. And so he's not to ask her to do something that's contrary to Scripture, but he's to be the leader. She's following his leadership. We saw that in the book of Genesis. It's now here in Ephesians 5. And Paul is making the point here that it's a picture of something. That this isn't just about who pays the bills and who cuts the grass and all sorts of things like that that we tend to focus on. This is about something bigger, and it's about the picture of the gospel. And Paul says this is a mystery that's being revealed, that was hidden before, that's now being revealed. And he's saying that the husband-wife relationship, it goes all the way back to Adam and Eve, that from the very beginning, the husband-wife relationship was designed to point to Christ and the church. Jesus Christ slain before the foundations of the earth. Christ, the church, the gospel. And so the furthering of the gospel is at stake in this. The picturing of the gospel is at stake in this. I don't want to have my marriage being a false picture of the gospel. I don't want my relationship with my wife to say something that's untrue about the gospel. And so we're here because of the gospel. The gospel is the centerpiece of everything. And if we want to have a gospel-centered home, then we're going to have a proper structure between husband and wife. Well, in the most of the places that I go, the men don't need to be convinced that they're to lead. They're students of the word, typically. They're in churches like your churches where the pastors are preaching the word faithfully, and they preach these passages in particular faithfully and believe these passages. Most men know that I speak to, most men know that they're supposed to be leading in the home and they're supposed to be picturing Christ in the church and the gospel. But the question they always have is, what does it look like? What are some of the details? We live in what sociologists are calling a fatherless culture, which means that a lot of young men are growing up without dads. They get into their families and marriages and homes, and they haven't had a real stellar example, and so they stumble a bit. Even at Southern Seminary, we have what I believe to be the best of the best young men training for gospel ministry. And many, many of them grew up in homes. Their dads left physically, or they were there physically, but not there emotionally, not present emotionally. And so they did not get some great training from their dads. And so they're asking basic questions of, what does this look like? How do I know if I'm doing this well? Can you give me some markers in this? And so what I'd like to do is a matter of application. So we've read the passage in Ephesians 5, and what I'd like to do is move directly into a little bit of application, some what I would call godly wisdom in terms of what this might look like if you're trying to lead in the home, and to give you 9 markers that you can kind of go back to help you be a guide as to whether or not you're doing well or not. So these are 9 areas where men should initiate in the home. 9 places where men, this doesn't mean that your wives are never going to do any of these things. It means, though, that typically, regularly, you're initiating in these things. So let's just jump right in. The first one would be in the area of vision. And by vision, I mean this is where we're going. This is not somebody had a dream one time and, you know, they have a vision. This is what do we want our family to look like 10 or 15 years from now? Most people have a vision for their home. They've never written it down. I would advise that you write it down, articulate what you want this thing to look like 10 to 15 years from now. How do we want our home to be characterized? What kinds of things do we want our home to be remembered for? What do we want our kids to say about our home when they leave our home? The top 10 things, the top 8 things. But what do we want this thing to look like? Vision is about result. What does it look like in the future if we have our way? And so you may want your sons to be biblically masculine, your daughters to be biblically feminine. You may want your home to honor God, encourage one another, to not have sibling rivalries. And so you just sit down and you articulate some things. This is not a complicated document. This is not a 20-page document. You could outline this in 1 page of what you want your home to look like 10 or 15 years from now. And then you might sit down with your wife. You never have a meeting with a blank document. That's a disaster. So go to the meeting with something with already written. And you might say to her, look, this is what I've been thinking. This is what I want our home to look like 10 or 15 or 20 years from now. And this is what I want our home to be characterized over the next 10 or 15 years. What do you think? Give her what your thoughts are, put them on paper, tell her to spend a week or so with it and pray about it and ask the Lord to give her wisdom about it. If your kids are old enough, you might get them involved with it, but this is typically between a husband and wife. The husband and wife relationship is the primary relationship in the home. The kids are secondary to the husband-wife relationship, and so this is predominantly a husband leading out and a wife responding to the leadership and adding in her wisdom to the document and begin to get some unity on the thing. You're not married? You should do this anyway. What do you want your home to look like? Start thinking about what this ought to look like, because you don't want to wait and get caught off guard and you meet some young woman and you haven't even thought about what kinds of things you want your home to look like, because if you have an idea what your home should look like, then you're going to have an idea of what your wife ought to be like and what kinds of characteristics she should be bringing to the table, and it'll help you solidify what you're looking for and it'll help you find a wife one day. So, vision, this is where we're going. Number 2, though, is just as important, is direction. And by direction, I mean this is how we get there. This is where you put some feet on the plan. This is where you map out some of the details of the plan. The weekly, maybe daily, but weekly, monthly, annual kinds of things you're going to put into place in order to carry out the vision. So you may have decided You want a strong marriage. I think that is what you ought to decide. You want a strong marriage. Who doesn't want a strong... Even lost people want strong marriages. Even a lost person, a non-believer, they don't go to the altar and to get married and say, you know, I really hope this thing doesn't work out. They're hopeful it's going to work out. They're giving themselves to something. They don't really know all the details of how to make it work out, but they're very hopeful it's going to work out. So everybody wants a strong marriage. Anybody can say they want a strong marriage, but this is where you say, what are we going to do? What might we do on a regular basis to cultivate a strong marriage? Well, this is where you map it out. In our home, the way we've mapped it out is, I don't know every single place I'm going to take my wife for dinner this year, but I do have a commitment. I'm going to take her out about 3 times a month, just the two of us, without the children. I also have it mapped out that twice a year, we get away for 3 to 4 days somewhere. It doesn't have to be expensive. It doesn't even have to be far away. But get away, just the two of us, without the kids, for 2, 3, 4 days, usually 3 or 4 days, just to get away, have some fun. Sometimes we plan. Sometimes we talk about our future and try to map out some things. But mostly it's just to hang out and have some fun and cultivate our relationship. We're going to read some Christian books on marriage annually, and I usually am able to pick those out and find some good books that way. We're going to talk about marriage with our friends, and we're going to have some friends that we get advice from, older couples. We have a couple of older couples that we regularly get advice from. And so we've mapped it out. This is not complicated. We want a strong marriage. We're going to put some things in place on a regular basis that we're going to do to try to cultivate a strong marriage. And so I want my boys to learn how to hunt. I want them to know how to do that. I grew up doing it. It's very fun to me. It's very enjoyable to me. And it's passed down. I mean, you don't just wake up one day and say, hey, I think I'll go buy a gun and go kill a deer. I mean, you don't just do that. That's something you learn, and there are safety issues and strategies that you need to know about on how you might be able to do that. And so we plan, what, a hunting trip. And we organize it, lay it out. We have the same time, same place, same time of year, same amount of time. And we go on an annual big-time hunting trip in South Georgia. It's the same thing. If you want your kid to know how to play baseball, what do you do? When they're 18, you buy them a glove, a ball, and a bat, and you say, go be a baseball player. No, you map it out. You decide very young they're going to play baseball, and they're going to roll them the ball when they can sit up, and they're going to hit a plastic bat and a plastic ball, and they're going to learn how to do it. Piano, violin, anything. We do this all the time with other things in life. Most men have the capacity to make these kinds of plans, and most men do make these kinds of plans regardless of what their vocation is. And so whatever your vocation is, you go to work on Monday and you have an agenda, you have a plan, you have some objectives that you need to accomplish, and then in your mind, at least, you've mapped out, what am I going to do today to accomplish this agenda? So we do this all the time. Most men do this all the time, and most men are successful in their vocations, but not very successful in their homes, partially because they don't transfer what they know to do every day in their vocation to the home. And so the planning that takes place in your vocation, the planning that takes place, even no matter what your responsibilities are, you show up at work with an agenda, with objectives, and with a plan to accomplish those objectives. And it's the same way for your home. Decide what you want your home to look like, and then take those 8 or 10 things and then map out a little bit on how you might accomplish that during the year and make that part of your plan. It's important to write these things down. And so we have 4 basic categories, a commitment to worship and honor God. And so that means we're going to get together on a regular basis as a family, and we're going to pray together. We're going to read the Word together. We're going to use the Word in our home to correct, to encourage. We're going to pray. So we have a commitment to worship and honor God in our home. We have a commitment to one another in our various relationships. So we have a husband-wife relationship, father-daughter, father-son, mother-daughter, mother-son. And we're going to do some things as a family. So we plan a family vacation. We plan to go camping a couple of times a year just to appreciate the outdoors and to enjoy God's creation. We have some father-son events, some father-daughter things that we do. Nothing complicated, but we put it on paper so that we're clear on what everybody's expectations are. We also include sports and some other things in that category. Then in the third, we have a commitment to our local church. What are our gifts? What does it mean to be a faithful member at our particular church where we are? And where are my gifts? Where are my wife's gifts? Where will we plug in? How will we serve? How will my children serve? What will they be involved with? What does it look like for them? Everybody's in a different season of life. And so right now, my wife is an incredible vocalist. She can sing really well. Right now, it's not for us for her to be in the choir. We have 7 kids. We've got a lot of things going on. Whenever they do the choir rehearsal, it isn't really conducive to what we're doing. And so right now, that's not part of the way she serves, but she serves in other ways. I serve in various ways. And so then, fourth, we have a commitment to our neighbors. This has to do with service, evangelism. How are we going to serve others this year? How are we going to, as a family, make a commitment to help others, serve others? How are we going to, how are we going to give our money in addition to our tithes and offerings? We have a separate category of giving that we give above and beyond those things. Where will we give that this year? How will we serve in building relationships with our neighbors? And so it's not complicated, but if you don't write it down, you don't really have a map. And if you don't have a map, it's very difficult these days to live family and to lead your family without some kind of written down, very broad but very basic written down plan. I would encourage all of you to write these things down. But number three, then, you got a vision, you've got a map out on how you're going to get there. The next area that a man needs to lead in is the area of instruction. And this is where I say, let me show you how. All right, every vision has its obstacles. And this is where you're going to anticipate obstacles. You have a big vision for your family. Everybody's agreed on it. We want to get here. But as a leader, you're responsible to help identify some of the obstacles that everyone's going to face and then prepare them for those obstacles. And so we rehearse in our home scenario after scenario of what might happen in certain situations and how we might handle it. This is incredibly important in terms of leadership, because you can't just say, hey, go get them. What you're going to say now is, I'm in there with you, and I've been down the road a little bit further than the rest of you children, and your mother and I have been down the road a little bit further than you, and so we've got this big vision, but here's some obstacles that you're going to face. And so I might rehearse moments with my daughter, such as, hey, in ballet rehearsal today, what might happen if 2 girls come up to you and say, hey, we're going to ignore Susie all day today. Can you do that with us? You want to do that with us? We're just going to ignore her. Now, those of you men that don't have daughters, girls can be really mean, okay? Guys have their own problems, but girls can be mean. And sometimes girls just get together and make a decision. They're going to be mean to somebody. Boys have their own way of working things out. We can have what looks like a barroom brawl in our front yard with the boys, and 5 minutes later, all the boys in the neighborhood are shooting baskets again like nothing ever happened. Girls don't operate that way, and so they have their own way of misbehaving. And so I'm helping my daughter prepare for what might happen with the boys. What happens if you're somewhere and somebody's messing with one of your sisters? What do you do? What if you're somewhere and there's a bully? What if you're somewhere and there's somebody who's being harmed and there's nobody else around to put an end to it? What are you going to do? How are you going to initiate? How are you going to respond? What's going to happen? What's going to happen on your ball team when the boys make fun of you because you don't use profanity when you strike out? What are you going to do with that? What's going to happen when you're over at somebody's house and you're there for an afternoon and the family decides they're going to watch a movie, and it's a movie you either know you're not allowed to watch, or it's a movie that you've never seen before, because our kids are not allowed to watch anything they've never seen before unless they call us from wherever they are. What are you going to do when the dad says, hey, we're going to watch this? What are you going to do? Well, in our home, because I'm a dad and I'm involved, my kids say, sir, my dad wouldn't want me to watch that. You know what that does? That gets me involved. I'm not even there, right? I'm involved. When my kids evoke my name, I don't think my dad would want me to watch that. Every man respects that. Every man, oh, your dad wouldn't want you to. It's not, so now the dad's not dealing with a 10-year-old saying, oh, it'll be fine. Well, the kids already brought me involved. I'm already involved. My dad wouldn't want me to watch that. Well, every man respects that. If you hear a kid say, my dad wouldn't want me to do it, just as a man, you just say, oh, well, all right then. Because now you're dealing with another grown man, and he's not even in the room, but this kid has brought, and so our kids are taught to get me involved. You evoke my name whenever you want to. If you're in trouble or you have a challenge, you just say, I don't think my dad would want me to do this. Or I need to talk to my dad, or can you ask my dad? Well, that changes everything. And my kids regularly will do that if there's a problem or a challenge or something they're not sure of. Get me involved. I'm involved, and I'm not even in that building. I'm not even in that particular neighborhood, but I get involved, and my kids know how to get me involved. And so let me show you how. This is how you prepare. And if you're leading anything, young men, whatever you're leading, if you're not married yet, you're going to lead something. And the way you lead, the way you prepare yourself to lead a family is when you're leading others in anything, you help prepare them for any obstacles that they might face. All right, number four is at the heart of leadership. Imitation. Watch me. Now, this is at the heart of leadership. Do what I do, or do what I say and not what I do, is failed leadership. It's hypocrisy. We can't do that. We've got to say to the rest of the people we're leading, I am not asking you to do something I am not willing to do myself. I am going to be doing the same things that I'm asking you to do. Kids are hypocrisy meters. They're hypocrisy detectors. My daughter, we play this game all the time called Settlers of Catan. Has anybody heard of this game? All right, it's an awesome game. It's a little complicated, but once you get past that, it is an awesome game. It's like a combination of Monopoly, Risk, and Life. And so it is just and the kids love it, and everybody's competitive in my house. Everybody, all the way down to my six-year-old daughter. Nobody, we do not play to lose. We play the game to win. Now, we're not mean to each other. We don't scream at each other. We don't use bad words against each other. But we do not play anything to lose. You play to win. And so we're competitive, and we're playing Settlers of Catan. And I make a trade with my daughter, and I said, whoa, no, I'm not going to do that. She said, well, you have to. What are you talking about, I have to? She said, well, it's in the rules. Now, everybody knows in my house, if somebody calls rules on me, it's a 10-minute delay minimum, because I'm getting the box out and I'm reading all the rules. We're going to find that rule. So I start to reach for the box top, and she puts the kibosh. She says, no, it's not on the box. It's a family rule. Oh, now you're bringing in a family rule on me. All right. Well, okay. Cheaters. What kind of family rule have you guys concocted while I wasn't looking? Here's what she says. You know, our family rule that says, let your yes be yes and your no be no. Oh, you're going to bed early for saying that. You are so going to bed early. What is she noticing? Just the hypocrisy. I said yes, and then I took it back. And she said, no, our family rule is let your yes be yes and your no be no. All right, fine. Changing that rule after this game's over. Can't even win at this game by playing like that. So I tell my kids, if I say it, you can say it. If I don't say it, you can't say it. Now, believe me, this makes me remarkably aware of my own speech. But it's true. There's not some words that I can say that they can't say. I mean, we're going to abide by the same rules here. And if I'm not supposed to say it, they're not supposed to say it. And if they're not supposed to say it, why would I be able to say it? So little things. I mean, obvious. There's some obvious things. We don't the major bad words. We're not using those in our house. But even other little things that are just maybe unique to our home, specific to our home. I believe in a little autonomy in the home, and we don't call people stupid. I just don't like the word. We just don't call people stupid. We don't call each other that. We don't call other people that. So what happens when we use the wrong word? When I do. Because inevitably, I'm in the car and somebody pulls out in front of me and there's just not another word in the English language that fits what I believe about that person who just pulled out in front of me. So the word stupid comes out. And the worst part is it's never when I'm by myself. It's always when I got all seven of the kids in that church van we're driving around. So what do? Well, you say, watch me while I show you what to do when you mess up. Because you're not saying, watch me, I'm never going to mess up. You just say, watch me. In as much as I follow Christ, that's what Paul says, in as much as I follow Christ, follow me. So you're telling your children, in as much as I follow Christ, follow me. And so follow me. When I do the right thing, follow me. When I do the wrong thing, I'll show you what to do when you mess up. And this is where you model the apology. Kids, I'm sorry I said that. We've agreed we're not going to call people stupid. I did it. I'm sorry that I said that guy was stupid. Will you guys forgive me for saying that? Yes, sir, we do. A lot of dads in particular think that if they apologize to their children for an obvious wrong, that it makes them look weak in the eyes of their children. That's not true. It builds resentment in the eyes of their children. They resent their dads because they know, and they know when you've done something wrong. They know when you violated a family rule. They know that when you've spoken harshly to their mother. They know that when you said you were going to do something and you don't do it. They know that. So don't think that by not apologizing they don't know it and that they ignore it. They don't ignore it. They just see the hypocrisy, and it builds resentment. And it leads to a belief that this thing isn't real. This is not authentic. Dad's talking about Christ and we're going to church all the time, but it doesn't have any impact on his life. And that's when we see children turning their hearts away from the gospel because they don't see any authenticity in it, particularly from their parents. Imitation, watch me. Number five is what I call inspiration. Inspiration. And here I will put the words, isn't this great? And here I have in mind the whole group. The leader of anything is responsible for the morale of the people that he's leading. And this is true. This is certainly true for men in the home. You are responsible for the morale of your home. And by that, I don't mean everybody's got to have a painted on plastic grin pretending like everything's perfect. I'm not talking about some kind of constant state of euphoria in the home. We don't have that. You don't have that. We're not even trying to create that. But it is important that the people that I'm leading in my home, my wife and my children, that they believe that I think this is the greatest family. That I love leading this family, that I think this family is incredible. And so all the time, no matter where I am, if we're at the dinner table, we're sitting in the living room, if I have them all together, sometimes I don't have them all together, I'll say something like, this is a great, and then I'll just stop. And everybody in unison will say, family. Why? Because I say it so often. They know I'm not getting ready to say, this is a great day, this is a great house, this is a great meal, this is a great family. I say it all the time. It is a part of our family vocabulary, and my kids know that I believe this is the greatest family. Who else is going to tell them this? Who else is going to tell them? They need to know that they believe that you believe what you're leading is a good thing. I say it all the time to my faculty. This is an awesome faculty. You guys, this is the greatest faculty. I wouldn't want to lead any other group of people right here. And my kids know I believe it. I really believe it. And our kids could say, yeah, but Dad, today somebody lied and somebody took somebody's toy and they stole a toy. And I know. I wouldn't want to be the dad to any other bunch of liars and thieves than this one right here. So I'm not ignoring the sin in our home, but I'm just telling you, you either believe it or you don't. If you don't believe it, then figure out how you can believe it, okay? Because it is a killer. It's like a dagger in the heart of a home if the dad, the man who's leading this thing, doesn't really believe it's any good. If you don't believe it's any good, then figure out why it isn't any good and help lead it to get it good, all right? I mean, that's just I don't know how to say it, and I don't want to be harsh about it, but the fact is you should believe this thing is awesome and communicate it to the people that you're leading. They need to know. And so I tell them all the time, who else is going to do that? It's not going to be other kids. It's not going to be any other kids telling them that. The kid across the street, he doesn't live there anymore, but he used to tell Gunner, your family's weird. That's what he told him. That doesn't bother me. It bothered Dana. He says our family's, I said, he doesn't believe our family's weird. Oh, yes, he did. He told Gunner our family's weird. Said, yeah, but he doesn't believe that. He's 14. And he's by himself all the time. His parents never pay any attention to him. And he sees us climbing in and out of that church van like ants all the time, going places, doing things together. He's got two choices. As a 14-year-old boy, he can walk across the street and tell Gunner, hey, you've got an awesome family and I wish I was part of it, which no 14-year-old boy in America is ever going to do. Or he can define a new normal for himself and just decide, well, I'm a normal. What I've got going on here is better, and I'm just going to tell everybody else they're weird. That's what he does. It's just a defense mechanism. He doesn't really mean it. But the point is, he's not telling Gunner. I can't wait for Isaac to come over and tell Gunner we've got a great family. Gunner's got to hear it from me. And he's got to hear it regularly from me. Georgia needs to hear it from me. Fisher needs to hear it from me. They need to know that that's what I believe. And that this is exciting for me. And this is a good thing for me. And I love doing what I do. Number six is more individual. Number six is what I call affirmation. And I'm going to put here, you're doing great. You're doing great. And here I have in mind the individual. If it is true, as I believe it is, that the husband and father is responsible for the morale of the home, then the key to morale is individual affirmation. You must not only say this is a great family, but then be able to say to each individual, here's what you do. You bring something to the table. Here's what you bring to help make this a great family. This is incredibly important, and I will regularly pull my kids aside and say, hey, you're doing great. Doing great at what? I don't know, just being my son, just being my daughter. You're doing a great job. I'll tell my kids on a regular basis, when your mother and I were thinking about having kids a long time ago, we thought it would be great. We had in mind it would be great. It is 10 times better. Having you as a daughter is 10 times better than I even thought it would be, and I thought it was going to be awesome to begin with. Now, it doesn't mean you're overlooking their sin. They don't think, oh, well, you know, I don't have to worry about the fact that I lied twice today or I disobeyed three times. That's not what you're doing. You're just noticing God's grace in their life. And you can pick out God's grace in their life without overlooking their sin and without brushing their sin under the carpet. And it's contagious. I'm just telling you, it's contagious. My six-year-old daughter, Willa, I put her to bed the other night. And you know what she said before she went to bed? You're a great dad. You know what I could have said? How do you know? How would she know? Right? What, has she got some comparison going on? Some kind of social science survey going on with a bunch of dads? She doesn't know if I'm a good one or not, just to be honest with you. How would she even know? She doesn't know anybody else's dad well enough to make a comparison. What is she doing? She's just saying it to me because I say it to her. It's contagious. That's all it is. There's nothing going on in her mind except, Dad always tells me I'm a great daughter, so I'm going to go for it. I'm telling him tonight he's a great dad. You're a great dad. That's all it is. It's just contagious. Saying nice, I mean, just think about this, guys. It's free, right? It's free. I had a guy in the seminary one time. I was trying to get him to bless his wife when he got home this afternoon. I always ask the young men on the campus, what you going to do today to bless your wife when you go home? Something nice. Just, it didn't have to be big, but what are you going to do? What's your reentry strategy at the end of the day today? He says, well, I don't know. I said, well, let's come up with something. What is she like? What is she like? Well, it's weird. Well, try me. What is it? Well, she likes it when I come in the door at the end of the day, she likes it if I kiss her first before I kiss the kids. I said, well, first of all, that's not weird. That's what I tell young men to do all the time. Secondly, you realize that's free, right? I mean, you've got that with you all the time. You don't have to stop at this grocery store. You don't have to stop at the florist. I mean, when you said weird, I thought you were going to say she likes these special flowers shipped in from Thailand or something like that, or you need to do somersaults in the end. She's asking you to kiss you first or kiss her first. That's free, my friend. And what I want to tell you is this idea of affirmation is free. You don't have to buy it. You don't have to search for it. You've got it with you all the time, everywhere you go. You go to Home Depot, don't go to Home Depot alone. Don't run to get milk alone. Don't go anywhere alone. Take one of your kids with you. And when you're in the car, you say something nice. That's just a very easy assignment that we miss. And I got to tell you, our kids want to be where they're affirmed, and when they're loved and they're cared for. I don't overlook my kids' sin. They know where I think their faults are, and I regularly, hopefully in a godly and loving way, will point them out as I see them, but that's not all I do. And I am more pouring it on the affirmation and the encouragement. And this home is a place where they want to be. Number 7 is evaluation. Number 7, evaluation. How are we doing? This is the hardest part. It's a burden. The burden of leadership is evaluation, and it is a burden. It's a weight that every man ought to feel on his shoulders. You young men, it's a weight you ought to feel on your shoulders, asking yourself, how are you doing? Where are you headed? Do you have a plan? Do you know where you want to go? If you don't know exactly where you want to go, have at least a direction you want to go, and then regularly ask yourself, am I going where I said I was going to go? This is just a fundamental part of leadership that most men don't like to do, because the most men tend to overestimate themselves, and they tend to overvalue what they're doing, and they tend to think more highly of themselves than they ought. And they don't like to see where they've failed, and so they don't look to see if they're failing. They don't look to see if they're missing the mark. But that's a major problem in leadership. You've got to ask yourself, are we going where we said we were going to go? How are we doing? Most men overestimate. So in marriage counseling, I always ask the man and the woman to come in, the young man, young woman, they come in. I ask the young woman, on a scale of 1 to 10, where are you? She'll say 4 or 5. And I'll ask the man, he'll say, I don't know, 7, 7.5. I'm like, you can't be a 7.5. You're in counseling. By definition, you have to be lower than a 7, right? I mean, you wouldn't even be here if you're a 7.5. He's just overestimating. And so look, this is not some kind of argument that my wife and I get in on a regular basis of how we're doing. This is me bringing to the table the question, how are we doing? And the more regularly I ask, the less painful the corrective is, right? The more regularly you evaluate, the less painful the correction is. You're just making little tweaks here and there. You let it get way over here, well, then you got to make a hard turn back, and it's a challenge. It can be done. But if you regularly evaluate, then you won't have the painful, big-time corrections. So number 8 is correction. Let's make a change. Number 8 is correction. Let's make a change. And there's nothing to say there. If you're not going to change, evaluation is just a conversation. That's nothing. You just admitted you were wrong, you admitted you're off course, and then you just stay on the course. So you've got to make the correction. That's part of leadership. And then number 9 is what I would call protection and provision. And here, I'll take care of you. And I'm going to try to finish here in 2 minutes. I'll take care of you. And this is just the overarching sentiment of leadership. You're telling your family, I'm not going anywhere. Good times, bad times, sickness and health, better for worse. I'm sticking around. I'm not going to leave you in the lurch. I'm going to be here. And I tell my wife this all the time. I tell my children this all the time. I'm not going anywhere. I tell my wife, I'm not going anywhere. I love you. I made a commitment to you, and I'm sticking with my commitment. And look, kids know that dads get sick, cancer comes into families, drunk drivers. I mean, there are all sorts of things that my kids know I can't protect them from. I can't protect them from the flu. I can't protect them from bad things happening out there, a reckless driver and all sorts of things. I can't do that, and that's not what they expect of me. What they expect of me is that through thick and thin, I'm going to be there with them in it, and that I'm going to regularly tell them that I'm going to be in it with them through thick and thin, and so that I'm going to give every drop of love and life and energy into this thing, and by God's grace, I can be counted on. That's all I'm saying. And that needs to be communicated on a regular basis. Our children think about whether or not we're going to leave them or not. You know why? Because there's so many of their friends whose dads have left. And so part of leadership is communicating your commitment. Your commitment. I tell that to my employees. I love this place. I have a commitment to this place. It doesn't mean I'm never going to work at another seminary, but what I'm telling them is I'm not looking right now. I'm here. You know what that makes them want to do? Be here and lock in and go where we're going and go where I'm headed. And that's what you want from your families. You want your family to say, man, I want to go where that guy's going. I want some of what that guy's got. That guy's in it. That guy's locked in here. And so we're going to lock in here. Leadership, that's the key. All right, it's a quarter till. I'm 5 minutes off. It's a quarter till. According to Pastor Bettis, we're going to take just a five-minute break. All right, only 5 minutes. And at 10 till, I'm going to start again. Is that correct? Oh. Oh, very good.